Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. In this episode from the Dublin Festival of History 2023, Anne Chambers tells us about Lord Sligo, from a youth of hedonistic self-indulgence in Regency England to a reforming, responsible legislator and landlord. Sligo became enshrined in the history of Jamaica as emancipator of the slaves and in Ireland as the poor man's friend. Anne Chambers is a biographer, novelist and screenwriter. This episode was recorded at the Central Library on the 4th of October 2023.
Among the many ancestral portraits on view in the Long Gallery in Westport House in County Mayo, one overshadows all the rest. And that is the enormous size portrait by the famous artist William Beechey of How Peter Brown, second Marquess of Sligo. Now, this portrait often is as a student in Cambridge, and it exudes all the youthful exuberance, confidence, and foibles of the typical Regency dandy. In a discreet corner, however, off the house, a more modestly sized portrait often showing him in middle age, and shows a face lined with experience, ill health, worries, and family responsibilities. And as I subsequently discovered, these two portraits are in effect visual depictions of a life journey from a youth of wealth, privilege, hedonistic self-indulgence to a mature, reforming, indebted, well-intentioned landlord, emancipator and family man. The life of How Peter Brown, second Marquess of Sligo, I have to tell you, reads like a melodramatic novel rather than a historical biography. 8 years in the research and writing, 15,000 contemporary manuscripts and letters, Sligo wrote letters as we send texts and emails today. This biography brought me on an exciting journey from Westport to the West Indies and many places in between, through some of the most significant events that shaped not just the history of Ireland, but also that of England, Europe and the West Indies. It also introduced me to a host of iconic figures from King George III, Mad King George, his son the Prince Regent, Queen Victoria, Napoleon and his extended family, the poets Byron and Thomas More, writer and drug addict Thomas de Quincey, politicians such as Grattan, Canning, Castlereagh, Talleyrand, Wellington, Palmerston and Daniel O'Connell, all of whom were connected either personally or politically with the subject of this biography. But who was this little known Irishman? Born in 1788, How Peter Brown was the adored and much indulged only child of John Dennis, first Marquess of Sligo, landlord of the Westport House estate in County Mayo. His mother was English-born Louisa Catherine, daughter of the famous British Admiral Sir Richard Howe, hence the name How Peter. This was the naval hero of the glorious 1st of June victory over the French in 1794, and he was also the trusted counsellor of King George III. So from the very beginning, How Peter, as we refer to him, became the consummate traveller, spending the first 2 years of his life in Lisbon, where for health reasons his father was forced to reside before returning to Westport. Because of his mother's close connection with the family of King George III, as a young student at Eton College, How Peter had literally the run of Windsor Castle. Indeed, there's a lovely incident referring to him skimming stones on the lake in Windsor Castle, and George III, who was going through one of his more rational periods, coming up and saying he missed a shot. You know, all of these things bring out the characters, both of the subject under research, but also the people whom they meet along the way. The famous writer Thomas de Quincey, whom How Peter befriended, and I mean that in a way that shows, you know, that during that time social status was so important. How Peter always tended to go beneath his own social status. Thomas de Quincey wrote indeed about their boyhood adventures together, both in Ireland and in England, in his famous autobiographical sketches. And he also wrote about the time he came on holidays to Westport And they went to Dublin to attend the last sitting of the Dublin Parliament here in College Green in 1800. And whereas De Quincey wrote, the Irish Parliament was dissolved without a murmur of protest. From Eton, how Peter entered Cambridge University. There he came under the influence of such notable Regency book figures of the day as Byron, Hobhouse, Tavistock and Lowther. All, as Byron wrote, and I quote, were energetically devoted to a villainous chaos of din, drunkenness, hazard, burgundy, hunting, mathematics, riot and racing. Not a bad, wouldn't mind being in there myself. In the fashionable coffee houses and clubs of the period, as well as in the salons of the famous Regency courtesans of the time, such as Harriet Wilson, with whom how Peter indeed had a brief affair, to Covent Garden, where, as Byron recorded in one of his memoirs, and I quote, they supped with seven whores, a bawd, and a ballet master in Madame Catalani's apartments. How Peter lived student life to the absolute limits. He also had entree to the royal residence of the then notorious leader of the Regency pack, the Prince Regent, who indeed later stood godfather for how Peter's eldest son, at Carlton House and at the famous, or should I say infamous, pavilion at Brighton. In 1810, at the height of the Napoleonic War, in the company of the radical Lady Hester Stanhope, I'm sure you've often heard her mentioned, she was known in history as the Nun of Lebanon, a great liberal woman for her day, and with her lover Michael Lavalette Bruce, how Peter set off on the mandatory grand tour, but one that was destined to turn out very, very differently from most. Charting a ship in Malta, the Mediterranean headquarters for the British fleet, which was then at war with France, to embark on a spot of treasure hunting, as you tended to do in these times, in Greece, short of a crew, he inadvertently took on board sailors from a crew of a British man of war, which lay anchored nearby in the harbour. Treasure hunting, well, we've heard a lot about that with the Elgin Marbles and all of that, and this is around the same time, but you know, there's another idea behind the treasure hunting by the aristocracy at the time. Greece was under the despotic control of Turkey at the time, and reports had come back, and indeed how Peter writes about it often said, as he watched the Turkish army take potshots at various monuments around Greece. And he was trained in Cambridge. He was very much interested in ancient Greece. He was trained by a famous professor and antiquarian, E.D. Clarke, who suggested to his students that to rescue these treasures in Greece from, as he called the Turks, the barbarians, and bring them back, put them on view in a museum, they would be protected and open to the public. So that's possibly just another slight change on what we usually hear about this treasure hunting. There was a good reason behind it, as we will see later how Peter did with his. Arriving in Greece, how Peter linked up with Byron, and the two friends journeyed on horseback from Athens to Corinth. How Peter's diaries and his numerous letters to his worried mother at home, with whom he kept in constant touch. Indeed, I often say the letters between the mother and the son would really make a book in itself. They're absolutely wonderful. They had a lovely, lovely rapport and connection that was very unusual for the time. These letters also show, more importantly, they talk about Byron's notorious conduct in Greece at that time, but they also, as he journeys through Greece and Albania, how Peter himself has perceptive observations on both countries which were then under Turkish rule. And they also show an awareness and appreciation of the rich heritage he encountered, and they really make for a really fascinating reading. A visit to Delphi to view the site of the famous oracle so reminded him of a valley near his home in Mayo that on his return he had renamed Delphi Valley, a name it still retains. I'm sure many of you have journeyed down that beautiful valley on to Lingnan from Louisbourg. During his travels in the Morea, he was accorded a state welcome by the then Turkish despot of the province, Veli Pasha, who presented him with many gifts. Perhaps one of the most important were the partly broken columns which once flanked the entrance to the fabled tomb of Agamemnon. how Peter brought these artefacts back to Westport House, where they remained forgotten in a basement for many decades. After his death, his grandson, realising their significance, in 1904 donated them to the British Museum, where they are now on public view at the entrance to Room 11, if you ever happen to be there, go and see them. On his return from his two-year travels in Eastern Europe, the incident with the British naval seamen at Malta finally caught up with him. Despite his status as a peer of the realm, an intimate of the royal family, grandson of the famous admiral, how Peter was indicted by the British Admiralty for kidnapping seamen in the King's service. In a celebratory trial at the Old Bailey in December 1812, which was attended by all his society friends and which hit the headlines of the newspapers of the day. God, it was across every single newspaper I looked at for that period. He was found guilty, fined the enormous sum of £5,000. In 1812, that was a lot of money, and imprisoned in Newgate Jail for 4 months. In true Gilbert and Sullivan style, on his release from prison, how Peter found that his mother, the then Dowager Marchioness of Sligo, had married his trial judge. You couldn't invent it. On his release, to let the embarrassment and shame of his imprisonment subside, he departed for Europe, travelling by coach from Sweden, down through the German states, through Austria and Switzerland, and on to Italy. His diaries and letters of the country's cultures, people and events he encountered during this period of the Napoleonic War are really fascinating. They include his visit to the famous Battle of Leipzig, witnessing Napoleon's retreat, of being one of the first people to arrive with the Allies in Paris following Napoleon's banishment to Elba. His encounters with such figures as Wellington and Castlereagh all provide a more personal and immediate view of this significant period of European history. As he also experienced a more personal relationship with the banished Emperor Napoleon, How Peter's subsequent visit to the island of Elba in May 1814 on a permit from the Emperor's jailer, Colonel Neil Campbell, but mainly through the influence of an Irish woman, Fanny Dillon, the Get Everywhere, wife of the Emperor's loyal Marshal, Henri Bertrand. Both of them are buried beside the Emperor in Les Invalides in Paris. How Peter was accorded a private meeting with the fallen Emperor. Now, the political implications of that, being the grandson of this famous English hero of all wars, to be received by the perceived enemy of England at the time. He was received by Napoleon at his residence on the island and wrote his impressions of the famous dictator to his mother. And he wrote, "Napoleon was dressed in a green uniform, very like the engraving I sent home of him, only fatter a good deal. He appeared in tolerably good spirits." How Peter's further letters to his mother from Elba, promising, as he wrote, to give a longer account of Napoleon, were subsequently intercepted by the British authorities. This and how Peter's later friendship with the Emperor's family, especially Caroline Bonaparte and her husband Joachim Murat, who then were the King and Queen of Naples and with whom he stayed for an entire year, gave rise to later rumours of how Peter's possible involvement in the conspiracy surrounding Napoleon's dramatic escape from the island of Elba some months later. Now, a lot of these papers were, you know, you had the Great Division of Europe going on at the time in Versailles. So there was a lot of hugger-mugger around this. But some of the letters, I even found a letter that Caroline Bonaparte entrusted to how Peter to give to her brother, the Emperor. So there's a lot of hugger-mugger, and it certainly would make for a marvellous movie, I'm sure, where you could fill in the blanks. While in Italy, how Peter also became involved in the notorious marital scandal that had evolved between his friend, the Prince Regent, and his estranged wife, Princess Caroline. Seeking hard evidence of his wife's adulterous conduct in Italy in order to obtain a divorce, the prince sought how Peter's assistance, adopting the role of amateur sleuth. Following the princess to Rome and Naples, how Peter promised his friend the prince, and I quote, "to write whatever evidence I may find in lemon juice." in the intervals of my letters, and by holding this close to the fire for a few moments, the writing will come out plain enough. Must remember that. How Peter's airy life as the proverbial Regency buck, however, came to an abrupt end on his marriage in 1816 to the love of his life and the future mother of his 14 children. The eldest daughter of the Earl of Clanrickard from Portumna, County Galway, Catherine de Bourgh was to be the loving and steadying influence on her husband and his most trusted confidant. As one of their children later observed, "My father was devoted to my mother and could never bear her out of his sight." So from the breakneck speed of his wild youth, how Peter settled down and devoted his energies and his money to rearing his large family and to his many responsibilities as a landlord in the west of Ireland. In an age in Ireland not overly endowed with improving landlords, he became the exception. He had inherited 200,000 acres of land in the west of Ireland. Now, this consisted mainly, I'm sure many of you know all the land around, down by the Reek and back into Leenane, of mainly poor quality land, which had to support at this time 10,000 subsistent tenants and labourers. Here we are today and we have our 135,000 farmers who now farm all of Ireland, complaining all the time they can. Can you imagine what that was like during that time? 10,000, what land could support that? It was an impossibility. Unlike in England, where the Industrial Revolution had absorbed such rural workers into the mills, mines and factories of the North and the Midlands, no such outlet was available in Ireland. This, combined with an alarming increase in the population that occurred in the first decades of the 19th century, which resulted in more and more people becoming dependent on the land, was eventually to lead, as we know, to the Great Famine in the 1840s. A passionate advocate of Catholic emancipation, as indeed had been his family, and multi-denominational education, he tried to set up. He had a thing about all religions, and he said they should stay where they belong, on the pulpit, and not get involved politically. But of course, this was happening at the time. He tried to set up a school for multi-denominational school in Westport, and he was stopped by the Archbishop of Tuam, Catholic, and the Protestant rector of Westport. He also set out to reform the legal system of Ireland at the time, which he described, and I quote, "a disgrace to my country." He also was to the forefront in the abolition of the notorious church tithes, where Catholics in Ireland were forced to pay for the upkeep of the Protestant church. He tried all to alleviate in every respect, as best he could, the desperate circumstances of his tenantry. With the market for linen, which had been established in Westport, indeed by his grandfather, by then totally undermined by British levies, he instead established cotton and corduroy factories. Indeed, his book of cotton samples is on view in Westport House today. In the town of Westport, to give additional employment outlets to his tenants, he encouraged the development of kelp harvesting and fishing and revitalised mine development in the area. I better say that very, very slowly in view of our present climate considerations. He promoted trade and other manufacturing in the town and port of Westport, and in 1825 influenced the establishment of the first commercial bank there. When famine engulfed the west of Ireland in 1831, we forget there was a famine that preceded the big famine of the 1840s, and this hit all along the western seaboard mainly, and it was as devastating indeed as the great famine that followed. During that famine, at his own expense, he imported cargoes of grain and potatoes, built a hospital and dispensary in Westport to care for the sick, and indeed went across to London, and through his society friends he raised additional funding for relief and additional public works. His efforts as an Irish landlord elicited praise, even from Daniel O'Connell in the House of Commons, who stated, "If the landlords of Ireland did what Lord Sligo is doing now, the country would not be reduced into a vast poorhouse." An inherited underlying medical condition, rheumatic, which indeed caused his father's death and indeed his own death very early, combined by a fall in encumbrance from his Irish estate as well as family interests, saw his improving and liberal endeavours transferred across the Atlantic Ocean to take on the brutal system of slavery. On his appointment in 1834 as Governor General of Jamaica and the Cayman Islands. There was a connection with the Brown family and Jamaica. Sligo had inherited two properties in Jamaica from his paternal grandmother, Elizabeth Kelly, daughter and heir of Dennis Kelly from County Galway, and the former Chief Justice of Jamaica. There was a huge connection, particularly between the west of Ireland and Jamaica, that goes back to the time that Jamaica indeed was ruled by Spain, before England took it from Spain. So that goes way back through the Port of Galway mainly. One of his properties produced sugar and its derivatives, rum and molasses, and the other cattle and sheep. Neither property produced much in the way of profit, because like every other absentee owner over the years, how Peter was defrauded by the middlemen, the notorious agents, managers and lawyers who had charge of both the slaves who worked these plantations and as well as the production. Both properties he had inherited had a total workforce of 500 slaves. Even from a distance, and long before his arrival in Jamaica, as is evidenced from his correspondence, he had shown an unusual interest and concern in the conditions and welfare of the slaves working on his properties. I came upon letters that he always kept copies of letters he sent to others, and I see from his managers, who he would never have met, asking how they were dressed, and could he send clothes from Ireland out to clothe his slaves better in Jamaica. There's another almost innocent letter going out wondering if his manager would put up notices to ask his slaves that if anybody had a complaint, they would write to him, care of Westport, Ireland. You know, the innocence in a way behind that concern is mind-boggling, really. On his arrival as governor of Jamaica, this concern that he had shown was to be dramatically intensified on being directly confronted with the savagery of the slavery system as it operated on the ground. Now, while the importation of slaves from Africa had been abolished in the British Empire in 1807, slavery, the cornerstone of sugar production and profit for so many, continued. Evangelical missionaries conveyed the horrors of slavery to the British public. And finally, in 1833, the British government finally passed the Emancipation Act, which Sligo was entrusted to implement in Jamaica. This Emancipation Act, however, did not give immediate freedom to the slaves, who merely became apprenticed to their masters for a further 6 years, with the plantation owners, including Sligo, being compensated for these changes by the British government. Described as slavery under another name, the controversial apprenticeship system was nonetheless resisted by the Jamaican plantocracy and by powerful commercial and political vested interests in Britain. As the owner of two plantations on the island, the Jamaican planters expected Sligo to be on their side. His objective, however, as he told them on his arrival as Governor General in April 1834, was to establish a social system, and I quote, absolved forever from the reproach of slavery. And this set them on a bitter, bitter collision course. I'm not a historian, I'm a biographer. As a biographer, you're interested in the person and how they react to a particular period of history. And that's what makes their letters and letters written about them by others so important, and which sets biography, I suppose, apart from history insofar as the person behind the historical time I am after, not necessarily just the historical period itself, but just how they impact it and it impacts them. Sligo found the savagery of the slavery system, I can see this from his letters, he encountered on the island personally apparent, from the flogging of field workers with cart whips, branding with hot iron, to the whipping of female slaves. The cruelties are past all idea, he told the Jamaican Assembly or government. I call on you to put an end to conduct so repugnant to humanity. To counteract the worst excesses He himself maintained personal contact and control over the 60 special magistrates he had appointed to oversee the implementation of the new apprenticeship system in the 900 plantations throughout the island. As he wrote to a friend, "It is treason in Jamaica to talk of a Negro as a free man, or to speak to him or to give him any knowledge of the extent to which the law protects him." Much to the derision and indeed indignation of their masters, and unprecedented in the colonies, to alleviate such inequality as reported in the papers, Sligo personally gave a patient hearing to the poorest Negro which might carry his grievance to Government House. He was also the first governor of the island to employ, and I quote, people of colour in his administration. A huge change at that time. Against opposition from the Jamaican Parliament, Sligo advocated the education of the black population so they might extract maximum benefit from their future freedom, and supported the building of the first schools on the island, two of which he established on his own property. He was also the first plantation owner to initiate a wage system for black workers on his properties, and later, after emancipation, to divide his lands into small farms which were leased to the former slaves. I visited there during the course of research for this, and I was accompanied by Lord Sligo's great-great-grandson at the time, the late Jeremy Altman from Westport House. And I can still remember the black people coming up to Jeremy with their descent from the former first free slaves that were established there. And it was a very, very momentous occasion, I'm sure, for him particularly. And it certainly, as an onlooker, as it was for me. His efforts to improve Jamaica's infrastructure, generate interest in land reclamation and better husbandry practices, as well as to steer the economy away from its dependence on sugar, led to the establishment of agricultural societies on the island of which he became patron. As he had done in Ireland, he set out to reform the Jamaican legal system. "In truth, there is no justice in the local institutions in Jamaica," he wrote. "Slavery has divided society into two classes. To the one it has given power, and to the other it has not given protection." His endeavours on behalf of the black majority, black population, were bitterly opposed by the planter-denominated Jamaican Assembly, who accused him, and I quote, of interpreting the laws in favour of the Negro, and who, as Sligo himself wrote, set out to make Jamaica too hot to hold me. Derisively referring to him, he had by this time become quite corpulent, as the great Leviathan of black humanity. They withdrew his salary and commenced a campaign of personal vilification against him in the Jamaican and in the British press. With the connivance of powerful commercial vested interests in Britain, whose fortunes depended on slavery, from not just plantation owners, but agents, merchants, ship owners, provisioners, manufacturers, importers, everybody who liked a spoon of sugar in their tea or coffee at the time, same as with the drugs today, it resulted in his removal from office in 1836. To the Jamaican black population, however, Lord Sligo was their champion and protector, as the pro-emancipation press, which he helped indeed to establish on the island, recorded. The shout of fiendish triumph that sends Lord Sligo from the shores of this colony is the prelude to the acclamations that will hail him as deliverer of the human race, as a friend of suffering humanity, as one of the truest champions of liberty. In an unprecedented gesture, the black population held a collection and presented him with a magnificent silver candelabra, which was inscribed, "In grateful remembrance, they entertain of his unremitting efforts to alleviate their suffering and to redress their wrongs during his just and enlightened administration of the government of Jamaica." Lord Sligo's personal experience in Jamaica turned him from being a supporter of the apprenticeship system into, as he wrote, "the warmest advocate for full and immediate emancipation." And on his return from Jamaica, he became active in the anti-slavery movement. One of his published pamphlets, which I found, Jamaica Under the Apprenticeship System, which outlines in vivid detail the atrocities and inequalities of slavery as he experienced them firsthand. This influenced the great debate on emancipation held in the British Parliament in February 1838. This pamphlet was also presented to Queen Victoria by the then Prime Minister, Lord Melbourne. Impatient with the lack of progress in the ongoing debate on slavery, on the 22nd of March 1838, being, as he wrote, well aware that it would put an end to the slavery system, Sligo rose in the House of Lords and announced that regardless of the outcome of the government's long deliberations, that he would free all apprentices on his own plantations in Jamaica on the 1st of August that year. I am confident, he said, that no person who is acquainted with the state of the West Indian colonies and at the same time is uninfected with colonial prejudices will deny that the time has now come when it is important to effect a final arrangement of this question. His public pronouncement made in the House of Lords left the British government with no alternative but to implement full and immediate emancipation for all on the same date, which they did. Sligo's efforts in the West Indies also influenced the struggle for emancipation in America. In September 1836, he travelled to New York and Philadelphia to meet with members of the then newly formed American Anti-Slavery Society, as well as with individual clergymen at the forefront of the emancipation struggle. America didn't have emancipation for many decades after the West Indies. And all who met him, as was recorded, formed an exalted opinion of his integrity and friendship for the poor. The ending of slavery brought with it financial ruin for most plantation owners, especially in Jamaica, which in the early 1840s was also experienced a severe and lengthy drought, as well as the reluctance of the newly emancipated black population to continue to work on the plantations, although now for a wage, and which consequently made sugar production on the island uneconomic. Sligo's own plantations fell into ruin. Thus, the partial fulfilment of his ambitions for the apprentices was won at the cost of the dismemberment of his Jamaican inheritance. Lord Sligo earned an honoured and respected place in the history of Jamaica, where he is acknowledged there as champion of the slaves, and where Sligoville, the first free slave village in the world, is named in his honour, and which indeed I visited. In 1838, his name, together with that of Wilberforce and Buxton, these were the leading figures in the anti-slavery movement, was commemorated on Emancipation Memorial Medal, struck especially to celebrate the ending of slavery. Now, we've all heard about Wilberforce and Buxton, but we've never heard mention of Sligo, and the three of them, their names on the same medal. How Peter died after a long illness in England in January 1845, at the relatively young age of 58. And just as the clouds of the Great Famine gathered ominously over his Irish estate, in accordance with his express wish, which is in his will, and I quote, "To be buried wherever I may die, that my funeral may be conducted in the plainest manner, and with as much privacy as possible." So to defray the expense of taking his body back to Ireland, he was interred in Kensal Green Cemetery in London, where he rests today. How Peter Brown, second Marquess of Sligo, lived his short life with an energy and all-encompassing passion. While not always adhering to his family motto, suivez raison, instead, as he admitted, "My judgment is shaped by my feelings," which indeed it was, a characteristic that often landed him in hot water. In his many endeavours, both public and private, he simply tried to do the right thing. As he readily admitted his own faults, so he tended to forgive those he encountered in others. His character and mindset, I always think, because of his travels and many visits to Paris, then the centre of that great age of enlightenment, I think his character and mindset were shaped and influenced in a much more cosmopolitan and liberal European rather than British milieu, which enhanced, enlightened, and shaped his attitude and endeavours on behalf of others less fortunate, for whom he felt responsible. And in so doing, I think he made a significant, if sadly forgotten, contribution to his time. I think also that many of the racially motivated inequalities and injustices that Sligo sought to eradicate during his lifetime, that they still exist today, 175 years after his death, undoubtedly he could not have envisaged. And as the statues of those implicated in the slavery system in the past are today being pulled down from their plinths, perhaps one should be erected to this man from the west of Ireland who helped to dismantle it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Dublin Festival of History. The festival is brought to you by Dublin City Council and organised by Dublin City Libraries, in partnership with Dublin City Council Culture Company. For further podcast episodes and for all the latest festival news, be sure to visit dublinfestivalofhistory.ie or follow us on Instagram.